content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading out of the January 11th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. This is our first new issue of the new year. And the cover drawing shows President Trump. He is inside, it looks like a block foundation wall. He's actually building the wall. It's up to about his chest height, and his tie is stuck between a couple of the blocks down below. He's got kind of a neutral look on his face and staring off into the distance. And the title is Boxed In, Trump's Vow to Keep Government Shut Until He Gets Wall Funding. And that, in fact, is our first main story. No end in sight for border wall shutdown fight. What happened? President Trump dug in this week on his demand that Democrats agree to fund his long-promised wall on the Mexican border, insisting he'd keep the federal government shut down until they capitulated. The partial government shutdown, which affects approximately 800,000 workers, will likely stretch into its third week, with Trump demanding $5.6 billion to build 200 miles of barriers he is alternately calling a wall, a see-through barrier, and steel slats. Democrats have refused to budge from their offer to extend $1.3 billion in border security funding, which includes money for enhanced surveillance and for reinforcing existing fencing in heavily populated areas. This week, the new Democratic majority in the House of Representatives was expected to quickly pass two bills funding the government at existing levels. "We are giving the Republicans the opportunity to take yes for an answer," said incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. The White House, however, called the Democrats' legislation a non-starter. The Senate voted unanimously for a stopgap funding bill last month that did not include funding for the wall after Trump indicated it had his support. But the president reversed course amid harsh criticism from right-wing pundits, including Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter. Last week, Vice President Mike Pence privately signaled to Democrats that Trump would be willing to accept roughly half of what he's asked for the wall. But Democrats, who believe most Americans oppose the wall and blame Trump for the shutdown, rebuffed the offer. Republican Senate leaders now say they won't bring any bill to a vote that Trump opposes. Trump insisted this week that $5.6 billion in taxpayer money is very little in comparison to the benefits of national security. The shutdown, he told a cabinet meeting, could last a long time. What the editorial said: President Trump has walled himself into a box canyon of his own design, said the Wall Street Journal. If he drops his demands for a wall, he'll be accused of surrender by his supporters. But if he holds firm, he'll likely shoulder the blame for the shutdown's impact on the public. The new Democratic majority in the House is feeling its oats and won't budge without an enticing offer. That's why Trump should trade a path to legalization for the Dreamers brought to the U.S. as children in exchange for border wall funding. If Democrats refuse, they'll be the ones who look small and cynical. "Let's be clear. This fight is not about security," said the New York Times. "A border wall would do nothing to address the nation's most pressing immigration issues. That includes the wave of Central American migrants who are legally applying for asylum at border checkpoints or turning themselves over to border agents. But Trump knows the wall is an important symbol to his xenophobic base, so he'll give them anything that he can claim meets the definition. In the meantime, about 800,000 federal employees and the citizens who depend on them are being hurt for an empty political stunt. What the columnist said, immigration hardliners could have had a wall if they really wanted one, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Democrats last year offered $25 billion in wall funding in return for legalizing the Dreamers, but the Trump administration nixed it. The truth, of course, is that all but the most rabid immigration hawks know the wall is ridiculous. The most vulnerable parts of the border already have 700 miles of fencing. In remote areas, construction would be difficult and expensive. Meanwhile, the number of people sneaking over the border has fallen dramatically, with about two-thirds of illegal immigrants entering the U.S. legally and overstaying their visas. But Trump can never admit his signature campaign promise is pointless, so we're stuck with an intractable shutdown. It's the Democrats who are intransigent, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. The party has supported border walls in the past, including 700 miles of new fencing that was included in the failed 2013 Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill. But the party has moved far to the left on immigration in reaction to Trump. Liberals increasingly see any new barriers on the southern border as beyond the pale, with Nancy Pelosi herself calling a border wall immoral. Both sides are convinced the standoff benefits them politically, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Polls show more Americans blame Trump for the shutdown and that the wall is generally unpopular, which is why Democrats won't give him any face-saving concessions. Trump nevertheless seems convinced that a big fight over the border will distract the new Democratic majority from launching committee investigations of him. It also plays well to his base, which he needs to keep angry and activated for his political survival. So the shutdown will continue until the political damage to Trump and the GOP becomes impossible to ignore. And we'll read the second main story this morning. The title is Mattis Departure Leaves a Hollowed Out Cabinet. What happened? President Trump headed into the new year with a makeshift cabinet featuring six acting department heads after Chief of Staff John Kelly was ousted from the White House and Secretary of Defense James Mattis resigned. Mattis announced his departure a day after Trump ordered the withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, a decision opposed by the Pentagon chief. The outgoing defense secretary forcefully rebuked Trump's foreign policy in his resignation letter, arguing the importance of supporting U.S. allies and of being unambiguous in dealing with authoritarian rivals such as Russia and China. "You have the right," Mattis wrote Trump, "to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects." Patrick Shanahan, Mattis' deputy and a former Boeing executive, is now acting Defense Secretary. Mattis and Kelly were viewed by many congressional Republicans and Democrats as the last, quote, adults in the room, experienced public servants and generals who would check Trump's impulses. In an exit interview with the Los Angeles Times, Kelly said he'd done his best to keep Trump informed and that his tenure as chief of staff should be judged by what Trump did not do. Sources said Kelly persuaded Trump not to withdraw U.S. troops from South Korea and Afghanistan and not to pull the U.S. from NATO. Trump has temporarily replaced Kelly with Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. The post of Attorney General, EPA Administrator, Interior Secretary, and Ambassador to the UN are also held by acting heads. What the editorial said. Cabinet officers come and go, said the Wall Street Journal, but Mattis' departure could reverberate in 2020. Trump didn't just overrule the secretary in ordering a Syrian withdrawal. He told America's military that he will act on uninformed impulse after a phone conversation with a Turkish dictator who's eager to attack our Syrian Kurdish allies. Many of Trump's, quote, deplorables are in uniform or are veterans. He has stuck a finger in their eye. Mattis worked ably to prevent or blunt dangerous presidential decisions, said the New York Times. Now that he's left, Congress must assert its national security responsibilities. It should pass legislation requiring that the secretaries of state and defense, not just the president, have a say in the use of nuclear weapons, and also requiring congressional approval to leave NATO and other treaties. What the columnist said. America should be deeply troubled by Mattis' letter, said David French in NationalReview.com. In that missive, America's most respected warrior told the nation he doesn't believe the president sees our enemies clearly or understand the necessity of American leadership. Trump has lost not only a defense secretary, said Aaron Dunn in WashingtonExaminer.com, but also national security credibility among key Senate Republicans. Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, and Mitch McConnell all voiced distress over Mattis' departure. Trump will need their help to rally GOP support in the Senate if he's impeached by the Democratic-controlled House. This resignation could well prove fatal to the administration. There's a common refrain you hear from cabinet members who leap or are pushed from the founding USS Trump, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Don't blame me. In his Los Angeles Times interview, Kelly absolved himself of guilt for the migrant family separation policy and the travel ban. Mattis did the same in his farewell letter, saying he always opposed Trump's attacks on NATO and his sucking up to Russia. It's not enough. Those who disagree with the madness had an obligation to resign, or at least to speak out, not to wash their hands of responsibility after the fact. Trump will soon have a cabinet full of yes-men, said Aaron Blake, also in the Post. Look at his replacements for other ousted officials. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo parrots Trump's talking points. The nominee for Attorney General, William Barr, attacked Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe in a memo to the Justice Department. National Security Advisor John Bolton tossed his anti-Russia views to win favor with his boss. Mattis' replacement will be cut from the same cloth because Trump simply won't be told no. Controversy of the week, Syria. Is Trump's withdrawal in America's interests? This was an impulsive act by an ignorant man, said David French in NationalReview.com. President Trump's abrupt decision to withdraw all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria has already lost him the service of Defense Secretary James Mattis, who resigned in protest. But the eventual cost to the nation could be much, much higher. By leaving Syria, we had a huge strategic gift to Russia and Iran, who have kept their own militaries in Syria as a means of expanding their influence in the Middle East. We abandon our Kurdish allies in northern Syria to the predations of Turkey, which has long sought the Kurds' destruction. It was during a phone call with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan that Trump shocked advisors by suddenly declaring the U.S. was pulling out. And he told Erdogan, "You know what? It's yours. I'm leaving." Worst of all, we give breathing room to ISIS's remaining 30,000 fighters, who may have lost the great swath of territory they once controlled, but are far from defeated, as Trump boasted in a tweet. If we've learned anything from two decades of war, said former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell in the Washington Post, it's that jihadist groups quickly regenerate when military pressure is reduced. By pulling U.S. troops out of Syria and by reportedly demanding a major withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, Trump has made it more likely that we will again face a threat to our homeland. Don't be fooled by these doom and gloom predictions of an ISIS resurgence, said Ubi Shabander in TheFederalist.com. As Trump has noted, Turkey is highly motivated to suppress ISIS and stabilize neighboring Syria, and its large local army can do that more efficiently than the U.S. The use of troops to prop up friendly governments in this region is doomed to failures. As we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's time to break the vicious cycle of the forever war and leave the quagmire of Syria to its regional stakeholders. The U.S. mission in Syria has been muddled from the start, said Michael Brendan Daugherty in NationalReview.com. We originally went in to support moderate Syrian rebel groups against dictator Bashar al-Assad, and then moved on to defeating ISIS. But hawks now tell us we need troops in Syria to limit Iranian and Russian influence. Enough mission creep. Time to go home. But even if ISIS stays in check, Trump's decision to leave Syria could still hurt him politically, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Despite the America First element of Trump's populist support, the conservative base is still more hawkish than isolationist. Hence the swift condemnation of the Syria pullout from Republican Senators Marco Rubio, who called it a major blunder, and Lindsey Graham, who predicted devastating consequences and likened it to President Obama's decision to withdraw troops from Iraq. That sharp criticism may explain why Trump this week acceded to more gradual withdrawal from Syria, 6 months instead of 30 days. That won't undo the damage from this impulsive decision, said William Galston, also in the Wall Street Journal. America made a commitment to protect our allies in the region, Israel, the Kurds, and Syrian rebel groups, who crafted their own high-stakes strategies around the continued presence of our troops in Syria. To abandon the Kurds and Syrians to their fate betrays everyone who relied on the word of the U.S., and it may be a long, long time before they, or anyone, trusts us again. Well, let's see what we have in our good week, bad week segment this first week in the new year. It was a good week for getting back to the garden with the announcement of a 3-day festival this summer in upstate New York to mark the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. No musical acts have been announced, but the organizers are also promising TED-style talks from leading futurists and retro tech experts. It was a good week for reassurance after the President of the United States welcomed the new year with an all-caps tweet urging anxious Americans to, quote, just calm down and enjoy the ride. And it was a good week for Oregonians who can now apply for roadkill salvage permits, allowing them to keep and eat deer and elk struck and killed by motor vehicles. The new regulations, however, prohibit motorists from intentionally hitting a deer or elk in order to salvage it. But it was a bad week for blood after Ronna Romney McDaniel, the Republican National Committee chairwoman, scolded her uncle, incoming Utah Senator Mitt Romney, for writing an op-ed in which he said President Trump has not risen to the mantle of his office. McDaniel said Romney's criticism is disappointing and unproductive. It was a bad week for folk wisdom after the 2019 edition of the Old Farmer's Almanac predicted above normal temperatures almost everywhere this winter, while the Farmer's Almanac called for teeth-chattering cold. And finally, it was a bad week for nuclear humor after the U.S. Strategic Command celebrated New Year's Eve with a tweet reminding Americans that it stands ready to drop something much, much bigger than the ball dropped in Times Square, with a video of a B-2 bomber dropping its exploding payload. The tweet was soon deleted. And before we move on, a boring but important item. Trump nixes raise for federal workers. President Trump issued an executive order last week freezing salaries for civilian federal workers, canceling a 2.1% raise set to kick in during the government shutdown. Trump announced his intention to block the 2019 raise early last year, calling it inappropriate. Military pay is allocated separately, and troops will see a 2.6% increase this year. Civilian federal employees have received annual raises of 1 to 2% since a freeze from 2011 to 2013. And Congress could still approve a raise as part of legislation to reopen the government. With Trump's announcement coming as 800,000 federal employees were furloughed or working without pay, National Treasury Employees Union President Tony Reardon said, "This is just pouring salt into the wound." We'll move on to our briefing page article. This week, the title is "An Epidemic of Loneliness." Nearly half of all Americans today say they are lonely. Why is that so, and what are the consequences? How is loneliness defined? Loneliness isn't determined by the actual number of friends or social contacts a person has. Social science researchers define loneliness as the emotional state created when people have fewer social contacts and meaningful relationships than they would like, relationships that make them feel known and understood. Essentially, if you feel lonely, you are lonely. One out of two Americans now falls into this category. In a recent study of 20,000 people by the health insurance company Cigna, about 47% of respondents reported often feeling alone or left out. 13% said they were zero people who knew them well. The U.S. is not unique in this respect. Loneliness is reaching epidemic levels throughout the developed world. 41% of Britons say the TV or pet is their main source of company. And the UK has created a cabinet-level minister to deal with the problem of rampant loneliness. A government study in Japan found that more than 500,000 people spent at least 6 months at home with no outside contact. During my years caring for patients, the most common pathology I saw was not heart disease or diabetes, said former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. It was loneliness. What impact does loneliness have? It makes people sick. A 2010 study by Brigham Young University found that loneliness shortens a person's life by 15 years, about the same impact as being obese or smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Other studies have found connections between loneliness and a wide range of health problems, including increased risk for heart attacks, stroke, and cancer. Lonely people are more likely to suffer from insomnia, depression, and drug abuse. They are also more likely to suffer from more rapid cognitive decline in old age. Why is physical health affected? Stress. The feeling of loneliness, scientists say, is an evolutionary phenomenon. Just as hunger encourages animals to find food, loneliness forces humans to seek out the protection of the group, increasing the chances of survival. To produce this behavior, loneliness triggers the release of stress hormones, particularly cortisol. In small doses, these hormones help make solitary humans more alert to danger, but they damage health if the body is exposed to them over long periods of time. Stress leads to high blood pressure, increased inflammation, and a weakened immune system. Without an emotional support network, lonely people are also more likely to slip into unhealthy habits, such as substance abuse, overeating, and not exercising. For seniors, isolation can be especially deadly in the event of an emergency, like a bad fall or a heart attack. Denying you feel lonely makes no more sense than denying you feel hunger, said John T. Cacioppo, a neuroscientist who studied loneliness at the University of Chicago. Is isolation more common? It appears to be. Between 1985 and 2009, the average American's social network shrank by more than one-third, defined by the number of close confidants. One reason for this is the aging of the baby boomers, who had fewer children and more divorces than their parents, leaving many without companions in their old age. About 1 in 11 Americans age 50 or older doesn't have a spouse, romantic partner, or living child. That's roughly 8 million people. 1 in 6 boomers lives alone. The increasingly transient nature of work is also making people lonely, as Americans leave family and hometowns behind in search of paychecks. Surprisingly, young people are actually most at risk of being lonely in modern society. In the Cygnus study, Generation Z members ages 18 to 22 and millennials ages 23 to 37 scored the highest for loneliness. Why are so many young people lonely? Americans are getting married and having children later in life. There are now more single people in the U.S. than at any time in the past 140 years. Not being part of a regular workplace also plays a role, with freelancers and gig economy workers reporting higher levels of loneliness. And despite seemingly infinite opportunities to connect online, social media may actually be making the problem worse. Scrolling through an endless stream of curated photos of parties, vacations, family gatherings, and weddings may increase feelings of being left out or dissatisfaction with one's own life. In one study of Americans ages 19 to 32, the top 25% of social media users were twice as likely to report feeling lonely as the people using it least. Some researchers say loneliness began becoming widespread long before the internet, when the Industrial Revolution broke up tightly knit agricultural communities. I do think it speaks to one of the dilemmas of modern mobile society, said Stephanie Kuntz, a historian at Evergreen State College. As we gain the freedom to become whatever we want to be, we've lost the sense of belonging. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with Why China Poses the Greatest Threat. China is America's biggest rival, said Kenny Zhu. And despite the media's obsession with Vladimir Putin, Russia isn't even close. American journalists are primarily focused on Russia because Trump's friendly posture toward Putin fits their narrative of Russian collusion in the 2016 election. But China poses a far more serious geopolitical threat. Its rapidly growing economy dwarfs Russia's. Indeed, China is on track to challenge the U.S. for global economic supremacy. China is also engaged in a massive military buildup, and its adventurism in the South China Sea and establishment of military bases and ports throughout East Asia signal its grand ambitions as a true global power. At the same time, China is seeking technological supremacy on the world stage as it expands its hacking abilities and theft of intellectual property while it attempts to establish a faster 5G telecom network throughout the world. At home, Chinese President Xi Jinping is strengthening his Orwellian control of his country's 1.4 billion citizens who have no choice but to obey the Communist Party's dictates. Putin's Russia is hanging on to the vestiges of a bygone era, but China is forging a new era, one it intends to lead. This column comes from France. Can Macron rise to global leadership? There's a vacancy in Western leadership, and Emmanuel Macron hopes to fill it, said Le Monde. Faced with the retreat and unilateralism of the U.S., the rising power of China, and the return of Russia to international affairs, the French president sees Europe as the champion of democracy and progressive values. And France, he believes, must lead. It can't be Germany, where Chancellor Angela Merkel is coming to the end of her reign, or the U.K., which is leaving the European Union. France already plays an outsized role in EU diplomacy, thanks to its many connections to Francophone countries in Africa. And once Brexit is complete, France, a nuclear power, will be the only EU country on the United Nations Security Council. Macron's ambition is clear, and his European and progressive convictions seem sincere, even passionate. Unlike so many European leaders, he is a stirring speaker who almost rivals Barack Obama, the gold standard. But after 19 months in office, Macron is deeply unpopular at home, and his inspiring foreign policy speeches about human rights and the environment have not been translated into deeds. Our president has a vision of a more just world. We can only hope he sees a way to achieve it. And this one comes from Japan. It's an editorial that says, aren't we killing enough whales? Determined to resume commercial whaling, Japan is quitting the International Whaling Commission in a huff, said the Asahi Shimbun. It's a short-sighted decision that is certain to damage our international credibility and may not even help our whaling industry much. Since Japan stopped commercial whaling 30 years ago to comply with the IWC moratorium, we have conducted scientific whaling, harvesting more than 300 non-endangered mink whales each year to study the species. Other members of the IWC say the research is just a guise for commercial whaling. But when Japan tried to come clean this year by asking for the right to conduct limited commercial whaling in our waters, the IWC refused. Walking away from the IWC will not suddenly make it legal for Japan to resume commercial whaling outside of its territorial waters. It will, however, prevent us from doing scientific whaling. Moreover, if we resume the hunt, do we want to risk our status as a country that respects international institutions to bolster a tiny industry? Whale meat accounts for a mere 0.1% of all meat consumption in the country. A better option is to work within the IWC and get it to appreciate our traditional whaling culture. Going it alone is not the modern Japanese way. On to the last word, our in-depth article. It has an intriguing title this week. In Search of an Inner Neanderthal. There had to be some kind of genetic explanation for her husband's atrocious table manners, said Jen Gilman-Perrott. It would just take a DNA test kit and some saliva to find it. A couple of years ago, I purchased a pair of 23andMe kits for myself and my husband, Tomer. I intended to scientifically prove that Tomer's most irritating behaviors were genetic destiny and therefore unchangeable. I'd grown tired of nagging him. Oftentimes, I'd hear my own voice rattling inside my brain in the same way a popular song might get stuck in my head. I needed an out, something to push me toward unconditional acceptance of my husband. My constant complaining yielded zero behavior modification on his part. On the other hand, it was changing me into a nasty micromanager. I briefly considered marital therapy, but that's an expensive undertaking, costing much more than the $398 one-time fee for both DNA kits. Plus, couples therapy could take a long time, requiring detours through our shared history. In much appealing contrast, 23andMe promised to launch us straight back to our prehistoric roots and might provide Tomer with something akin to a formal pardon note, thereby permitting me to stop fighting against him once and for all. I imagined we could help others by way of example, too, for what long-married woman has not suffered her husband's most banal tendencies? The socks and underwear on the floor, the snoring. Not me, because my husband puts his used clothes in the hamper, and I'm the snorer. Really, I'm probably blessed as far as masculine disgustingness goes, but my husband is flawed in one repulsive way. His barbaric table manners. I have no doubt this is a genetic situation, for even back when we were first dating, I'd shuddered upon seeing my future father-in-law poke through the serving bowls of a family-style meal with his bare, hairy hands. My husband's father has also been caught eating ice cream directly from the carton, the thought of which I now appreciate for its built-in binge deterrent. Moreover, my father-in-law eats like a caveman conqueror, reaching across dinner plates to pluck a taste of this or that from his mortified tablemates. A family dinner looks like a scene straight out of Game of Thrones, minus any crowns. And so, when my husband first began to exhibit similar behaviors, I had to wonder, had I suffered some rare form of blindness previously? Did some barrier of unconscious denial gently shield my eyes each day, year after year, but only at mealtimes? It was as if a blindfold suddenly fell from my face, or as if Tomer had finally removed a mask from his own. My gentleman turned into a beast, seemingly overnight. I watched with horror one Sunday evening as my husband served himself a plate of meat and vegetables with his hands. His fingers ripped skirt steak in lieu of cutting it with a knife. He abandoned his fork altogether, and I lost my appetite. Around the same time, Tomer stopped liking forks. He'd adopted a paleo diet, versions of which are known as a caveman diet. He'd cut all processed food from his intake, eating nothing but meat, nuts, vegetables, and fruits. "My stomach is no longer a quivering idiot," Tomer said, and he said it more than once to countless friends and family members, until he'd worked up a complete narrative on how he'd triumphed over his very own stomach. And each time he told this story, he lifted his shirt, pounding his fist upon his midsection. His proud smile began to appear, well, wild and hungry, as if he'd tamed his digestive system, but in doing so had activated a primitive gene and sacrificed his own civility. Shortly thereafter, I came across an article pertaining to Neanderthal DNA. According to modern science, the Neanderthals and our prehistoric ancestors mated, leaving many of us with a small percentage of Neanderthal DNA. I did more Googling and learned that 23andMe can tell you how much Neanderthal DNA you carry. Although they do mean different things, in my mind's eye, the word Neanderthal and caveman summoned identical images, that of savage meat-eating maniacs ripping raw meat from bone with fat fingers and jagged teeth. And this was it, the thing that sold me on 23andMe, the chance to determine one's degree of Neanderthal-ness. Without any consideration of all the possible consequences of submitting one's DNA to a global database, I ordered two kits, grinning and convinced that my husband's result would show a statistically significant and above-average number of Neanderthal variants in his genome. Since Father's Day was only a month away, I decided I'd gift-wrap the kits upon arrival, too. I'd kill two birds with one stone. On Father's Day, Tomer unwrapped the kits with feigned enthusiasm. Poor guy. I'm sure he would have preferred a drone or a new barbecue, but my selfish interest had interfered with those wishes. The kits ended up on the bottom shelf of a bedroom nightstand, collecting dust for a month until Tomer and I finally got around to collecting our spit. We watched a YouTube video on the proper collection technique, and I started to spit first, and then one of our children screamed from the other room, something about spilled lemonade, pulling Tomer away from our mutual undertaking. By the time he returned to our bedroom, he'd accidentally eaten something and drunk a glass of water. The directions specifically state not to do this. "Forget it," Tomer said. "I'm too tired. I'll do mine tomorrow." I ended up packaging my DNA sample all by its lonely self for the outgoing mail. Tomer's kit went back on the nightstand where it sat for another 6 months, at least. My results arrived rather quickly. An email from the company announced that my reports were available online for viewing. I cannot lie. It all felt a bit like Santa had arrived, like I was a child once again stumbling half awake into a living room overflowing with sparkling rubber-wrapped gifts. Who am I? Now I would know. I calmed down soon enough. My ancestry, it turns out, was hardly surprising. Mostly Italian and Polish, framed by a mosaic of numerous other European countries. Exactly 1% of my DNA was attributed to Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, 0.5% from each side, and I proudly posted this in a Facebook update for my Jewish husband's family to see. I was a real member of the tribe, if only by a mere drop. It was later that night, after celebrating my newfound Jewishness, that I remembered to look for Neanderthal DNA. I quickly found the link and clicked it with the casual ease of someone who does not think of herself as a Neanderthal at all. The reality seeped in like a slow poison, because when I first viewed my number of Neanderthal variants, 297, I had no context for knowing what significance this number held, if any. It took a moment to locate that information, and when I did, I discovered, to my horror, that 297 Neanderthal variants placed me in the 81st percentile of all 23andMe users. I'm well above average for Neanderthalness. Only 19% of other 23andMe customers can claim worse. I almost kept this unfortunate fact to myself, but in search of immediate consolation, I told Tomer. "I have terrible news," I said. "I'm highly Neanderthal, which means you must be like ultimate level Neanderthal, Tomer. I imagined would be in the 99th percentile for Neanderthal variants." "Who cares? I love you just the way you are," he said, referencing our wedding song with a wink. I went online to read more about Neanderthal traits. Surprisingly, my idea of a super hairy Neanderthal was all wrong. One of my Neanderthal variants, for instance, is associated with having a decreased amount of body hair on one's back. This was my consolation prize, a lower annual expense for body waxing. Finally, and almost a full year after Father's Day, Tomer collected his spit because he couldn't take my nagging anymore. By the time his results came in, the passage of time had rendered me numb to my own degree of Neanderthalness, though I still looked forward to welcoming Tomer into the club. Tomer himself showed zero interest in his results. "I don't care. You can log into it, Let me know what you find out, he told me. I clicked onto his reports with disappointment one feels after reading a lengthy novel that never delivers a climactic moment. I saw that Tomer is 82% Ashkenazi Jewish, no surprise there, and likely yawned. Then I clicked the link for Tomer's Neanderthal information and, in an unforeseen plot twist, to my great shock, learned that Tomer carries less Neanderthal DNA than 88% of all other users on the site. I quickly checked my own account. Perhaps I'd previously misread my report. But no, on my personal list of DNA relatives on the site, I'm in first place for Neanderthalness. Next to my name and number one rank, 23andMe features an illustration, too. A blue cartoon-like image of a caveman's profile alongside what appears to be a prehistoric tool of some kind, maybe a spear. For Father's Day this year, I purchased Tomer a drone through Amazon. He practically tore open the box, then called his brother and father, who immediately drove over to help him assemble his new toy. I watched as he fit pieces together without the aid of the instruction manual, a task my own brain could never manage. My mother is quite good at this sort of thing, so I don't need 23andMe to tell me that my inferior gene for mechanical engineering is from the paternal side of my family. My father couldn't even change a light bulb. My husband, by contrast, put together a drone and flew it over our backyard, proving he is more than a meat-loving caveman, at least up until the moment the damn drone fell from the sky and refused to recharge itself, though we plugged it in numerous times. How much did you pay for this? My husband asked. About $200, I said. He sighed. I love this gift. It's really the best thing you could have thought to get me, Tomer said, kissing the top of my head. But a decent drone, even a good beginner's drone, cost at least $1,000. I offered to return it and buy him a better one. We'll definitely return it, Tomer said, but I'll wait for science to advance and lower the cost. It was another Father's Day gift fail. Still, I marveled that for around the same price as a crappy drone, I had uploaded human DNA to a database that in turn sent me ancestral and medical reports. Later that afternoon, Tomer's extended family assembled in our kitchen for dinner. I prepared a salad while Tomer grilled rib eyes and sausages. The drone was a bust, but we still had to eat. Our kids and nephews grew irritable with hunger. My husband plopped a few steaks upon our kitchen island, and I watched him tear meat from the bone, then dangle it over his upturned face, catching blood-tinged drops with his tongue before dropping it all into his mouth in one gigantic catch. He was still chewing when he said, "At the end of the day, nothing's better than a great piece of steak." My father-in-law and brother-in-law hustled over toward the kitchen island, grabbing a slab of meat and some sausage for themselves, too. My sister-in-law, Joanne, who's married to my husband's brother, looked at me and sighed. "We're married to cavemen," she said, rolling her eyes. My mom warned me, but I didn't listen. Usually I'd enjoy adding a snarky remark or two, but with unprecedented restraint, I kept my mouth shut and resisted any linguistic impulsivity. I don't know if my prehistoric ancestors were linguistic or impulsive, or neither or both. But self-control, Neanderthal or not, felt like a new achievement. And it was Father's Day, after all. I left my husband enjoy his caveman meal in peace. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in longreads.com. We read one of the obituaries this week. The sitcom star who became a big-name director. Penny Marshall, 1943 to 2018. Penny Marshall was an unlikely Hollywood success story. She spoke in a nasal Bronx accent and as an aspiring actress played a homely girl opposite Farrah Fawcett in a TV shampoo ad. But after a 1975 Happy Days episode in which the Fonz finds two girls for a double date, Marshall was on a path to stardom. That episode marked the debut of her Laverne DeFazio and Cindy Williams' Shirley Feeney, the title characters of spinoff sitcom Laverne and Shirley, which became America's most watched show during its 1976 to 83 run. Marshall then moved behind the camera, helming Big, 1998, and A League of Their Own, 1992, and becoming the first woman to direct movies that earned more than $100 million. Resolutely self-effacing, she claimed to be mystified by her cinematic achievements. "I'm not an articulate person," Marshall said, "but I have a strange combination of insecurity and fearlessness." Marshall was born in the Bronx in 1943 to a showbiz family, said the Associated Press. Her father was an industrial filmmaker. Her mother taught tap dance, and her older brother, Gary, would create Happy Days and direct Pretty Woman. Marshall got her first real break in 1971 when her brother, then a producer at ABC, cast her as Jack Klugman's gloomy secretary, Myrna Turner, on the TV's The Odd Couple, said the New York Times. Viewers fell in love with her poker-faced humor and Bronx-accented whine, assets she deployed again on Laverne and Shirley, about two Milwaukee brewery employees who share misadventures in dating and work. Marshall directed several episodes and in 1986 took over the Whoopi Goldberg spy comedy Jumpin' Jack Flash after the original director dropped out. That film was only modestly successful, said the Washington Post, but it led to Big, a comic fantasy starring Tom Hanks as a boy who magically transforms overnight into an adult. She followed it with medical drama Awakenings, 1990, and then directed Gina Davis and Hanks in A League of Their Own, about the women who played professional baseball during World War II. Reviewers found Marshall's movies sentimental, but she saw nothing wrong with aiming for the heart. "I like corny," she said. "I like what moves me." And we'll go right on over to the talking points page. Here's an article for you. The Democrats, why Bernie fans fear Beto. "The first skirmish of the 2020 Democratic primary is underway," said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. "In recent weeks, supporters of Bernie Sanders have leveled a wave of attacks at Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who became a Democratic darling in November by almost beating Senator Ted Cruz in a deeply Republican state. O'Rourke's rise poses an obvious threat to the party's leftist wing. He's a mainstream Democrat who often expresses broad sympathy for left-wing policy goals while suggesting he favors a more pragmatic alternative. That is pure heresy to Sanders socialists, who demand fealty to an uncompromising left-wing agenda, including Medicare for all and free college tuition. Even more alarming to Bernie's fans is O'Rourke's Obama-like personal appeal. Like Obama, he's handsome, charismatic, and has proven that he can raise huge sums of money. For the next 18 months, the fight between mainstream liberals and socialists will consume the Democrats and determine whom the party nominates for president. Democrats should be deeply suspicious of Beto-mania, said Zaid Gilani in Current Affairs. O'Rourke refused to sign on to bills supporting single-payer health care and free college in Congress, where he rarely challenged the party establishment. Maybe that's because this so-called progressive is a white male Ivy League graduate who married the daughter of a billionaire. In 2020, practically any Democrat has a good shot at beating a historically unpopular Donald Trump, said Elizabeth Brunig in the Washington Post. So why run another wishy-washy centrist? Democrats have a historic opportunity to elect a candidate with a bold, clear, distinctly progressive agenda. Sorry, but Sanders supporters do not get to have a monopoly on what it means to be a progressive, said Peter Hanby in Vanity Fair. In the Senate race, O'Rourke campaigned on an unapologetically liberal platform that included expanding Medicaid, banning assault-style rifles, and passing the DREAM Act. He also was one of the few Democrats to challenge Obama's inhumane deportation policy. Sanders is a darling to the left because he was the only alternative to Clinton in 2016. But in 2020, there will be a bumper crop of progressive candidates to choose from, with O'Rourke and others championing ideas that Sanders helped push into the Democratic mainstream. If you inhabit the American left today, you suddenly have choices, including O'Rourke. And enough time for a couple of short notes. 56% of workers over age 50 are laid off or pushed out of their jobs at least once before they leave the workforce for good. Only 1 in 10 of those workers ever goes back to earning the same amount of money. 32% of Latinos voted for Republican candidates in the midterm election. Evangelical Christians make up about 1/4 of Latino voters, while military veterans make up 13%. Both of these groups are about evenly split between the two parties. President Trump tweeted 2,843 times in 2018, an increase from 2,277 tweets in 2017. Of those, 52% were tweets promoting himself or his administration, while 32% were devoted to attacking his adversaries. And we'll finish with a quote from Ogden Nash. Children aren't happy with nothing to ignore, and that's what parents were created for. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you've got questions or comments, please give us a call. 919-832-5138.